safe! Safe!
Safe, safe. Duddit's growing agitated now. We really don't have any more time, Owen said. Roberta, Henry said, please. Let me come, she cried. He's all I have.
Amma,
Duddit said. His voice was not a bit childish.
Ooh, hey, here.
She looked at him fixedly, and her face sagged.
All right, she said. Just one more minute. I have to get something.
She went into Duddit's room and came back with a paper bag, which she handed to Henry.
It's his pills, she said. He has his prednisone at 9 o'clock. Don't forget, or he gets wheezy and his chest hurts. He can have a Percocet if he asks, and he probably will ask, because being out in the cold hurts him.
She looked at Henry with sorrow, but no reproach. He almost wished for reproach. God knew he'd never done anything which had made him feel this ashamed. It wasn't just that Duddit's had leukemia. It was that he'd had it for so long, and none of them had known. Also his lemon swabs, but only on his lips, because his gums bleed a lot now and the swabs sting them. There's cotton for his nose if it bleeds. Oh, and the catheter. See it there on his shoulder? Henry nodded, a plastic tube protruding from a packing of bandage. Looking at it gave him a weirdly strong feeling of déjà vu.
If you're outside, keep it covered. Dr. Briscoe laughs at me, but I'm always afraid that the cold will get down inside. A scarf will work, even a handkerchief.
She was crying again, the sobs breaking through.
Roberta, Henry began.
Now he was looking at the clock, too. I'll take care of him, Owen said. I saw my pop through to the end of it. I know about prednisone and Percocet. And more. Bigger steroids, better painkillers. At the end, marijuana, methadone, and finally, pure morphine. So much better than heroin. Morphine, death's sleekest engine.
He felt her in his head then, a strange tickling sensation like bare feet so light they barely touched down. Tickly, but not unpleasant. She was trying to make out if what he'd said about his father was the truth or a lie. This was her little gift from her extraordinary son, Owen realized, and she had been using it so long she no longer even knew she was using it. Like Henry's friend Beaver chewing on his toothpicks. It wasn't as powerful as what Henry had, but it was there, and Owen had never in his life been so glad he had told the truth.
Not leukemia, though, she said.
Lung cancer.
Mrs. Cavell, we really have to.
I need to get him one more thing.
Roberta, we can't, Henry began.
In a flash, she darted for the kitchen.
Owen felt really frightened for the first time. Kurtz and Freddy and Perlmutter. Henry, I can't tell where they are. I've lost them.
Henry had unrolled the top of the bag and looked inside. What he saw there, lying on the top of the box of lemon-flavored glycerin swabs, transfixed him. He replied to Owen, but his voice seemed to be coming from the far end of some previously undisclosed, hell unsuspected, valley. There was such a valley. He knew that now. A trough of years. He would not, could not, say he had never suspected that such geography existed, but how in God's name could he have suspected so little?
They just passed exit 29, he said. 20 miles behind us now, maybe even closer.
What's wrong with you?
Henry reached into the brown bag and brought out the little creation of string, so like a cobweb, which had hung over Duddit's bed here, and over the bed at the Maple Lane house before Alfalfa had died.
Duddit's. Where did you get this? He asked, but of course he knew.
This dream catcher was smaller than the one which had hung in the main room at Hole in the Wall, but was otherwise its twin.
Ear, Duddit said.
He had never taken his eyes off Henry.
It was as if he could still not entirely believe that Henry was here.
Ear, Aunt Louie. All right, Isthmus, as we.
Although his mind-reading ability was fading rapidly as his body beat back the virus, Owen understood this easily enough. Beaver sent to me, Duddit said, for my Christmas, last week. Down's sufferers had difficulty expressing concepts of time past and time to come, and Owen suspected that to Duddit's, the past was always last week, the future always next week.
It seemed to Owen that if everyone thought that way, there would be a lot less grief and rancor in the world. Henry looked at the little string dream catcher a moment longer, then returned it to the brown bag, just as Roberta bustled back in. Duditz broke into a huge grin when he saw what she'd gone for.
"Ooby-doo!" he cried. "Ooby-doo, Anax!"
He took it and gave her a kiss on each cheek.
"Owen," Henry said. His eyes were bright. "I have some extremely good news."
"Tell me."
"The bastards just hit a detour. Jackknife tracked a trailer just shy of exit 28. It's going to cost them 10, maybe 20 minutes.
"Thank Christ, let's use them." He glanced at the coat tree in the corner. Hanging from it was a huge blue duffel coat with Red Sox Winter Ball printed on the back in bright scarlet.
"That yours, Duditz?"
"Ein,"
Duditz said, smiling and nodding.
"I act it."
And as Owen reached for it,
"Who's ein Ozzy?"
Owen got that one too, and it sent a chill up his back. You saw us find Josie. So he had. And Duditz had seen him. Only last night, or had Duditz seen him on that day 19 years ago? Did Duditz's gift also involve a kind of time travel? This wasn't the time to ask such questions, and Owen was almost glad.
"I said I wouldn't pack his lunchbox, but of course I did. In the end, I did."
Roberta looked at it, at Duditz holding it, shifting it from hand to hand as he struggled into the enormous parka, which had also been a gift from the Boston Red Sox. His face was unbelievably pale against the bright blue and even brighter yellow of the lunchbox.
"I knew he was going, and that I wasn't."
Her eyes searched Henry's face.
"Please, may I go, Henry?"
"If you do, you could die in front of him," Henry said, hating the cruelty of it, also hating how well his life's work had prepared him to push the right buttons.
"Would you want him to see that, Roberta?"
"No, of course not." And as an afterthought, hurting him all the way to the center of his heart, "Damn you." She went to Duditz, pushed Owen aside, and quickly ran up her son's zipper. Then she took him by the shoulders, pulled him down, and fixed him with her eyes. Tiny, fierce little bird of a woman. Tall, pale son floating inside his parka. Roberta had stopped crying.
"You be good, Duddy."
"I will, Mama."
"You mind Henry."
"I will, Mama. I mind Henry."
"Stay bundled up."
"I will."
Still obedient, but a little impatient now, wanting to be off, and how all this took Henry back. Trips to get ice cream, trips to play mini-golf. Duditz had been weirdly good at the game. Only Pete had been able to beat him with any consistency. Trips to the movies. Always, "You mind Henry," or "You mind Jonesy," or "You mind your friends." And always, "You be good, Duddy," and
"I am, Mama."
She looked him up and down. "I love you, Douglas. You have always been a good son to me. And I love you so very much. Give me a kiss now." He kissed her. Her hand stole out and caressed his beard, sandy cheek. Henry could hardly bear to look, but he did look, was as helpless as any fly caught in any spider web. Every dream catcher was also a trap. Duditz gave her another perfunctory kiss, but his brilliant green eyes shifted between Henry and the door. Duditz was anxious to be off. Because he knew the people after Henry and his friend were close? Because it was an adventure, like all the adventures the five of them had had in the old days? Both? Yes, probably both. Roberta let him go, her hands leaving her son for the last time.
"Roberta," Henry said,
"why didn't you tell any of us this was happening? Why didn't you call? Why didn't you ever come?" Henry might have asked another of his own. Why didn't Duditz call? But the very question would have been a lie. Duditz had called repeatedly since March when Jonesy had had his accident. He thought of Pete sitting in the snow beside the overturned scout, drinking beer and riding Duditz over and over again in the snow. Duditz, marooned in Never Never Land and dying there. Duditz sending his messages and receiving back only silence. Finally, one of them had come, but only to take him away with nothing but a bag of pills and his old yellow lunchbox. There was no kindness in the dreamcatcher. They had meant only good for Duddits. Even on that first day, they had loved him honestly. Still, it came down to this. Take care of him, Henry. Her gaze shifted to Owen. You too. Take care of my son, Henry said. We'll try. There was no place to turn around on Dearborn Street. Every driveway had been plowed under. In the strengthening morning light, the sleeping neighborhood looked like a town deep in the Alaskan tundra. Owen threw the Hummer in reverse and went flying backward down the street, the bulky vehicle's rear end wagging clumsily from side to side. Its high steel bumper smacked some snow-shrouded vehicle parked at the curb. There was a tinkle of breaking glass, and then they again burst through the frozen roadblock of snow at the intersection, swerving wildly back into Kansas Street, pointing toward the turnpike. During all this, Duddits sat in the back seat, perfectly complacent, his lunchbox on his lap. Henry, why did Duddits say Jonesy wants war? What war? Henry tried to send the answer telepathically, but Owen could no longer hear him. The patches of virus on Owen's face had all turned white, and when he scratched absently at his cheek, he pulled clumps of the stuff out with his nails. The skin beneath looked chapped and irritated, but not really hurt. Like getting over a cold, Henry marveled. Really, not more serious than that. He didn't say war, Owen. War, Duddits agreed from the back seat. He leaned forward to look at the big green sign reading 95 southbound.
Owen's on war.
Owen's brow wrinkled. A dust of dead virus flakes sifted down like dandruff.
What?
Water, Henry said, and reached back to pat Duddits's bony knee. Jonesy wants water, is what he was trying to say. Only it's not Jonesy who wants it, it's the other one, the one he calls Mr. Gray. Roberta went into Duddits's room and began to pick up the litter of his clothes. The way he left them around drove her crazy, but she supposed she wouldn't have to worry about that anymore. She had been at it scarcely 5 minutes before a weakness overcame her legs, and she had to sit in his chair by the window. The sight of the bed, where he had come to spend more and more of his time, haunted her. The dull morning light on the pillow, which still bore the circular indentation of his head, was inexpressibly cruel. Henry thought she'd let Duddits go because they believed the future of the whole world somehow hinged on finding Jonesy and finding him fast. But that wasn't it. She had let him go because it was what Duddits wanted. The dying got signed baseball caps. The dying also got to go on trips with old friends. But it was hard. Losing him was so hard. She put her handful of T-shirts to her face in order to blot out the sight of the bed, and there was his smell. Johnson's shampoo, Dial soap, and most of all, worst of all, the arnica cream she put on his back and legs when his muscles hurt. In her desperation, she reached out to him, trying to find him with the two men who had come like the dead and taken him away, but his mind was gone. He's blocked himself off from me, she thought. They had enjoyed, mostly enjoyed, their own ordinary telepathy over the years, perhaps only different in minor degree from the telepathy most mothers of special children experienced. She had heard the word rapport over and over again at the support group meetings she and Alfie sometimes attended. But that was gone now. Duddits had blocked himself off, and that meant he knew something terrible was going to happen. He knew. Still holding the shirts to her face and inhaling his scent, Roberta began to cry again. Kurtz had been okay, mostly okay, until they saw the road flares and blue police light bars flashing in the grim morning light, and beyond it, a huge semi lying on its side like a dead dinosaur. Standing out front, so bundled up his face was completely invisible, was a cop waving them toward an exit ramp. Fuck, Kurtz spat. He had to fight an urge to draw the 9 and just start spraying away. He knew that would be disaster. There were other cops milling around the stalled semi, but he felt the urge, all but ungovernable, just the same. They were so close, closing in by the hands of the nailed-up Christ, and then stopped like this.
Fuck! Fuck! Fuck!
What do you want me to do, boss? Freddy had asked. Impassive, behind the wheel, but he had drawn his own weapon, an automatic rifle, across his lap.
If I nail it, I think we can skate by on the right. Gone in 60 seconds.
Again, Kurtz had to fight the urge to just say,
"Yeah, punch it, Freddy, and if one of those blue suits gets in the way, bust his gut for him."
Freddy might get by, but he might not. He wasn't the driver he thought he was, that Kurtz had already ascertained. Like too many pilots, Freddy had the erroneous belief that his skills in the sky were mirrored by skills on the ground. And even if they did get by, they'd be marked, and that was not acceptable. Not after General Yellow Balls Randall had hollered blue exit. His get-out-of-jail-free card had been revoked. He was strictly a vigilante now.
Got to do the smart thing, he thought. That's why they pay me the big bucks. Be a good boy and just go the way he's pointing you, Kurtz said. In fact, I want you to give him a wave and a big thumbs up when you take the ramp. Then keep moving south and get back on the turnpike at your earliest opportunity.
He sighed. Lord love a duck. He leaned forward, close enough to Freddy to see the whitening fuzz of Ripley in his right ear. He whispered, ardent as a lover.
And if you ditch us, laddie buck, I'll put a round in the back of your neck.
Kurtz touched the place where the soft nape joined the hard skull.
Right here.
Freddy's wooden Indian face didn't change.
Yes, boss.
Next, Kurtz had gripped the now nearly comatose Perlmutter by the shoulder and had shaken him until Pearlie's eyes at last fluttered open.
Leave me alone, boss. Need to sleep.
Kurtz placed the muzzle of his 9mm against the back of his former aide's head.
Nope. Rise and shine, Buck. Time for a little debriefing.
Pearlie had groaned, but he had also sat up. When he opened his mouth to say something, a tooth had tumbled out onto the front of his parka. The tooth had looked perfect to Kurtz.
Look, Ma, no cavities.
Pearlie said that Owen and his new buddy were still stopped, still in Derry.
Very good. Yummy.
Not so good 15 minutes later as Freddy sent the Humvee trudging down another snow-covered entrance ramp and back onto the turnpike. This was exit 28, only one interchange away from their target, but a miss was as good as a mile.
They're on the move again, Perlmutter said.
He sounded weak and washed out.
God damn it!
He was full of rage. Sick and useless rage at Owen Underhill, who now symbolized, at least to Abe Kurtz, the whole sorry busted operation. Pearlie uttered a deep groan, a sound of utter, hollow despair. His stomach had begun to rise again. He was clutching at his cheeks, wet with perspiration. His normally unremarkable face had become almost handsome in his pain. Now he let another long and ghastly fart, a passage of wind which seemed to go on and on. The sound of it made Kurtz think of gadgets they'd constructed at summer camp 1,000 or so years ago, noisemakers that consisted of tin cans and lengths of waxed string, bull roarers they'd called them. The stench that filled the Humvee was the smell of the red cancer growing in Pearlie's sewage treatment plant, first feeding on his wastes, then getting to the good stuff. Pretty horrible. Still, there was an upside. Freddy was getting better, and Kurtz had never caught the damned Ripley in the first place. Perhaps he was immune. In any case, he had taken off the mask and tossed it indifferently in back 15 minutes ago. And Pearlie, although undoubtedly ill, was also valuable. A man with a really good radar jammed up his ass. So Kurtz patted Perlmutter on the shoulder, ignoring the stench. Sooner or later, the thing inside him would get out, and that would likely mean an end to Pearlie's usefulness. But Kurtz wouldn't worry about that until he had to.
Hold on, Kurtz said tenderly. Just tell it to go back to sleep again.
You fucking idiot, Perlmutter gasped.
That's right, Kurtz agreed. Whatever you say, Buck.
After all, he was a fucking idiot. Owen had turned out to be a cowardly coyote, and who had put him in the damn hen house? They were passing exit 27 now. Kurtz looked up the ramp and fancied he could almost see the tracks of the Hummer Owen was driving. Somewhere up there, on one side of the overpass or the other, was the house to which Owen and his new friend had made their inexplicable detour.
Why?
They stopped to get Duddits, Perlmutter said. His belly was going down again, and the worst of his pain seemed to have passed, for now at least.
Duddits? What kind of name is that?
I don't know. I'm picking this up from his mother. Him, I can't see. He's different, boss. It's almost as if he's a gray boy instead of human.
Kurtz felt his back prickle at that.
The mother thinks as if this guy Duddits as both a boy and a man, Pearlie said.
This was the most unprompted communication from him Kurtz had gotten since they left Goslin's. Perlmutter sounded almost interested, by God.
Maybe he's retarded, Freddy said.
Perlmutter glanced over at Freddy.
It could be. Whatever he is, he's sick, Pearlie sighed. I know how he feels.
Kurtz patted Perlmutter's shoulder again.
Chin up, laddie. What about the fellas thereafter, this Gary Jones and the supposed Mr. Gray?
He didn't much care, but there was the possibility that the course and progress of Jones, and Gray, if Gray existed outside of Owen Underhill's fevered imagination, would impact upon the course and progress of Underhill, Devlin, and... Duddits? Perlmutter shook his head, then closed his eyes, and leaned his head back against the seat again. His little spate of energy and interest seemed to have passed.
Nothing, he said. Blocked off.
Maybe not there at all?
Oh, something's there, Perlmutter said. It's like a black hole.
Dreamily, he said,
I hear so many voices. They're already sending in the reinforcements.
As if Perlmutter had conjured it, the biggest convoy Kurtz had seen in 20 years appeared in the northbound lanes of I-95. First came two enormous plows as big as elephants running side by side with their cliff-like blades, spuming up snow on either side, bearing both lanes all the way down to the pavement. Behind them, a pair of sand trucks, also running in tandem. And behind the sand trucks, a double line of army vehicles and heavy ordnance. Kurtz saw shrouded shapes on flatbed haulers and knew they could only be missiles. Other flatbeds held radar dishes, rangefinders, God knew what else. Interspersed among them were big canvas-back troop carriers, their headlamps glaring in the brightening daylight. Not hundreds of men, but thousands, prepared for God knew what, World War III, hand-to-hand combat with two-headed creatures, or maybe the intelligent bugs from Starship Troopers, plague, madness, death, doomsday. If any of Katie Gallagher's Imperial Valleys were still operating up there, Kurtz hoped they would soon cease what they were doing and head for Canada. Raising their hands in the air and calling out Il n'y a pas d'infection ici wouldn't do them any good, certainly. That ploy had already been tried. And it was all so meaningless. In his heart of hearts, Kurtz knew Owen had been right about at least one thing. It was over up there. They could shut the barn door, praise God, but the horse had been stolen.
They're going to close it down for good, Perlmutter said. The Jefferson Tract just became the 51st state, and it's a police state.
You can still key on Owen?
Yes, Perlmutter said absently. But not for long. He's getting better, too, losing the telepathy.
Where is he, Buck?
They just passed exit 25. They might have 15 miles on us, not much more.
Want me to punch it a little, Freddy asked.
They had lost their chance to head Owen off because of the goddamn semi. The last thing in the world Kurtz wanted was to lose another chance by skidding off the road.
Negative, Kurtz said. For the time being, I think we'll just lay back and let him run.
He crossed his arms and looked out at the linen-white world passing by. But now the snow had stopped, and as they continued south, road conditions would doubtless improve. It had been an eventful 24 hours. He had blown up an alien spacecraft, been betrayed by the man he had regarded as his logical successor, had survived a mutiny and a civilian riot, and, to top it all off, he had been relieved of his command by a sunshine soldier who had never heard a shot fired in anger. Kurtz's eyes slipped shut. After a few moments, he dozed. Jonesy sat moodily behind his desk for quite a while, sometimes looking at the phone, which no longer worked, sometimes at the dream catcher, which hung from the ceiling, it wafted in some barely felt air current, sometimes at the new steel shutters with which that bastard Gray had blocked his vision, and always that low rumble, both in his ears and shivering his buttocks as he sat in his chair. It could have been a rather noisy furnace, one in need of servicing, but it wasn't. It was the plow, beating its way south and south and south. Mr. Gray behind the wheel, likely wearing a DPW cap stolen from his most recent victim, horsing the plow along, working the wheel with Jonesy's muscles, listening to developments on the plow's CB with Jonesy's ears. "So, Jonesy, how long are you going to sit here feeling sorry for yourself?" Jonesy, who had been slumping in his seat, almost dozing in fact, straightened up at that. Henry's voice. Not arriving telepathically, there were no voices now, Mr. Gray had blocked all but his own, but rather coming from his own mind. Nevertheless, it stung him. "I'm not feeling sorry for myself. I'm blocked off." Not liking the sulky, defensive quality of the thought, vocalized, it would no doubt have come out as a whine. "Can't call out, can't see out, can't go out. I don't know where you are, Henry, but I'm in a goddamn isolation booth." "Did he steal your brains?" "Shut up," Jonesy rubbed at his temple. "Did he take your memories?" "No, of course not." Even in here, with a double-locked door between him and those billions of labeled cartons, he could recall wiping a booger on the end of Bonnie Deal's braid in first grade and then asking that same Bonnie to dance at the seventh-grade harvest top 6 years later, watching carefully as Lamar Clarendon taught them to play the game, known as cribbage to the low and uninitiated, seeing Rick McCarthy come out of the woods and thinking he was a deer. He could remember all those things. There might be an advantage in that, but Jonesy was damned if he knew what it was. Maybe because it was too big, too obvious. "To be stuck like this after all the mysteries you've read," his mind's version of Henry taunted him. "Not to mention all those science fiction movies where the aliens arrive, everything from The Day the Earth Stood Still to Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, all of that, and you still can't figure this guy out, can't follow his smoke down from the sky and see where he's camped." Jonesy rubbed harder at his temple. This wasn't ESP, it was his own mind, and why couldn't he shut it up? He was fucking trapped. So what difference did it make anyway? He was a motor without a transmission, a cart without a horse. He was Donovan's brain, kept alive in a tank of cloudy fluid and dreaming useless dreams. What does he want? Start there. Jonesy looked up at the dreamcatcher, dancing in the vague currents of warm air. Felt the rumble of the plow, strong enough to vibrate the pictures on the walls. Tina Jean Slossinger. That had been her name. And supposedly, there had been a picture of her in here. A picture of her holding her skirt up so you could see her pussy. And how many adolescent boys had been caught by such a dream. Jonesy got up, almost leapt up, and began to pace around the office, limping only a little. The storm was over, and his hip hurt a bit less now. "Think like Hercule Poirot," he told himself. "Exercise those little gray cells. Never mind your memories for the time being. Think about Mr. Gray. Think logically. What does he want?" Jonesy stopped. What Gray wanted was obvious, really. He had gone to the standpipe, where the standpipe had been anyway, because he wanted water. Not just any water, drinking water. But the standpipe was gone, destroyed in the big blow of 85. Ha ha, Mr. Gray got you last. And Derry's current water supply was north and east, probably not reachable because of the storm, and not concentrated in one place anyway. So, Mr. Gray had, after consulting Jonesy's available store of knowledge, turned south again. Toward? Suddenly, it was all clear. The strength ran out of his legs, and he collapsed to the carpeted floor, ignoring the flare of pain in his hip. The dog. Lad. Did he still have the dog? Of course he does, Jonesy whispered. Of course the son of a bitch does. I can smell him even in here, farting just like McCarthy. This world was inimical to the virus, and this world's inhabitants fought with a surprising vigor which arose from deep wells of emotion. Bad luck. But now the last surviving gray boy had had an unbroken chain of good luck. He was like some Daffy in the zone Vegas crapshooter rolling a string of sevens. 4, 6, 8, oh goddamn a dozen in a row. He had found Jonesy, his typhoid Mary, had invaded him and conquered him. He had found Pete, who had gotten him where he wanted to go after the flashlight that Kim had given out. Next, Andy Janis, the Minnesota boy. He had been hauling the corpses of 2 deer killed by the Ripley. The deer had been useless to Mr. Gray, but Janis had also been hauling the decomposing body of one of the aliens. Fruiting bodies, Jonesy thought randomly. Fruiting bodies. What's that from? No matter, because Mr. Gray's next 7 had been the Dodge Ram, old Mr. I Heart My Border Collie. What had Gray done? Fed some of the Gray's dead body to the dog? Put the dog's nose to the corpse and forced him to inhale of that fruiting body? No, eating was much more likely. Come on, boy, chow time. Whatever process started the weasels, it began in the gut, not the lungs. Jonesy had a momentary image of McCarthy lost in the woods. Beaver had asked, "What the hell have you been eating? Woodchuck turds?" And what had McCarthy replied? "Bushes and things. I don't know just what. I was just so hungry, you know." Sure. Hungry. Lost, scared, and hungry. Not noticing the red splotches of virus on the leaves of some of the bushes, the red speckles on the green moss he crammed into his mouth, gagging it down because somewhere back there in his tame, oh gosh, oh dear lawyer's life, he had read that you could eat moss if you were lost in the woods, that moss wouldn't hurt you. Did everyone who swallowed some of the virus, grains of it, almost too small to be seen floating in the air, incubate one of the vicious little monsters that had torn McCarthy apart and then killed the beeve? Probably not. No more than every woman who had unprotected sex got pregnant. But McCarthy had caught. And so had Lad. "He knows about the cottage," Jonesy said. Of course. The cottage in Ware, some 60 miles west of Boston. And he'd know the story of the Russian woman. Everyone knew it. Jonesy had passed it on himself. It was too gruesomely good not to pass on. They knew it in Ware, in New Salem, in Cooleyville, and Belchertown, Hardwick and Packardsville and Pelham, all the surrounding towns. And what, pray tell, did those towns surround? Why, the Quabbin. That was what they surrounded. Quabbin Reservoir, the water supply for Boston and the adjacent metropolitan area. How many people drank their daily water from the Quabbin? 2 million? 3? Jonesy didn't know for sure, but a lot more than had ever drunk from the supply stored in the dairy standpipe. Mr. Gray, rolling 7 after 7, a run for the ages, and now only 1 away from breaking the bank. 2 or 3 million people. Mr. Gray wanted to introduce them to Lad, the border collie, and to Lad's new friend. And delivered in this new medium, the virus would take. Chapter 20. The Chase Ends. South and south and south. By the time Mr. Gray passed the Gardner exit, the first one below Augusta, the snow cover on the ground was considerably less, and the turnpike was slushy, but 2 lanes wide again. It was time to trade the plow for something less conspicuous, partly because he no longer needed it, but also because Jonesy's arms were aching with the unaccustomed strain of controlling the oversized vehicle. Mr. Gray didn't care much for Jonesy's body, or so he told himself. In truth, it was hard not to feel at least some affection for something capable of providing such unexpected pleasures as bacon and murder. But it did have to take him another couple of hundred miles. He suspected that Jonesy wasn't in very good shape for a man in the middle of his life. Part of that was the accident he'd been in, but it also had to do with his job. He was an academic. As a result, he had pretty much ignored the more physical aspects of his life, which stunned Mr. Gray. These creatures were 60% emotion, 30% sensation, 10% thought, and 10%, Mr. Gray reflected, was probably on the generous side. To ignore the body the way Jonesy had seemed both willful and stupid to Mr. Gray. But of course, that was not his problem, nor Jonesy's either. Not anymore. Now, Jonesy was what he had apparently always wanted to be, nothing but mind. Judging from the way he'd reacted, he didn't actually care for that state much once he had attained it. On the floor of the plow, where Lad lay in a litter of cigarette butts, cardboard coffee cups, and balled-up snack wrappers, the dog whined in pain. Its body was grotesquely bloated, the torso the size of a water barrel. Soon the dog would pass gas, and its midsection would deflate again. Mr. Gray had established contact with the Byram growing inside the dog, and would hence regulate its gestation. The dog would be his version of what his host thought of as the Russian woman, and once the dog had been placed, his job would be done. He reached behind him with his mind, feeling for the others. Henry and his friend Owen were entirely gone, like a radio station that had ceased to broadcast, and that was troubling. Farther behind, they were just passing the Newport exits, 60 or so miles north of Mr. Gray's current position, was a group of three with one clear contact, Pearlie. This Pearlie, like the dog, was incubating a Byram, and Mr. Gray could receive him clearly. He had also been receiving another of that group, Freddy, but now Freddy was gone. The virus on him had died. Pearlie said so. Here was one of the green turnpike signs, rest area. There was a Burger King here, which Jonesy's files identified as both a restaurant and a fast food joint. There would be bacon there, and his stomach gurgled at the thought. Yes, it would be hard in many ways to give this body up. It had its pleasures, definitely had its pleasures. No time for bacon now, however. Now it was time to change vehicles, and he had to be fairly unobtrusive about it. This exit into the rest area split in two, with one road for passenger vehicles and one for trucks and buses. Mr. Gray drove the big orange plow into the parking lot for trucks, Jonesy's muscles trembling with the strain of turning the big steering wheel, and was delighted to see four other plows, practically identical to his own, all parked together. He nosed into a space at the end of the line and killed the engine. He felt for Jonesy. Jonesy was there, hunkered in his perplexing safety zone. "What you up to, partner?" Mr. Gray murmured. No answer, but he sensed Jonesy listening. "What you doing?" No answer still. And really, what could he be doing? He was locked in and blind. Still, it would behoove him not to forget Jonesy. Jonesy with his somehow exciting suggestion that Mr. Gray forego the imperative, the need to cede, and simply enjoy life on Earth. Every now and then a thought would occur to Mr. Gray, a letter pushed under the door from Jonesy's haven. This sort of thought, according to Jonesy's files, was a slogan. Slogans were simple and to the point. The most recent said, "Bacon is just the beginning." And Mr. Gray was sure that was true, even in his hospital room. What hospital room? What hospital? Who is Marcy? Who wants a shot? He understood that life here was very delicious. But the imperative was deep and unbreakable. He would seed this world and then die. And if he got to eat a little bacon along the way, why, so much the better. Who was Richie? Was he a tiger? Why did you kill him? No answer, but Jonesy was listening, very carefully. Mr. Gray hated having him in there. It was, the simile came from Jonesy's store, like having a tiny fishbone stuck in your throat, not big enough to choke you,
but plenty big enough to bug you. You annoy the shit out of me, Jonesy.
Putting on his gloves now, the ones that had belonged to the owner of the Dodge Ram, the owner of Lad. This time, there was a reply.
The feeling is mutual, partner. So why don't you go someplace where you're wanted? Take your act and put it on the road.
Can't do that, Mr. Gray said. He extended a hand to the dog, and Lad sniffed gratefully at the scent of its master on the glove. Mr. Gray sent it a be calm thought, then got out of the plow and began to walk toward the side of the restaurant. Around back would be the employees' parking lot.
Henry and the other guy are right on top of you, asshole, sniffing right up your tailpipe. So relax. Spend as much time here as you want. Have a triple order of bacon.
They can't feel me, Mr. Gray said, his breath puffing in and out in front of him. The sensation of the cold air in his mouth and throat and lungs was exquisite, invigorating. Even the smells of gasoline and diesel fuel were wonderful.
If I can't feel them, they can't feel me.
Jonesy laughed. Actually, laughed. It stopped Mr. Gray in his tracks beside the dumpster.
The rules have changed, my friend. They stopped for Duddits, and Duddits seize the line.
I don't know what that means.
Of course you do, asshole.
Stop calling me that, Mr. Gray snapped. If you stop insulting my intelligence, maybe I will. Mr. Gray started walking again. And yes, here, around the corner, was a little clutch of cars, most of them old and battered.
Duddits seize the line.
He knew what it meant, all right. The one named Pete possessed the same thing, the same talent, although likely not as strongly as this puzzling other, this Duddits. Mr. Gray didn't like the idea of leaving a trail Duddits could see, but he knew something Jonesy didn't. Pearlie believed that Henry, Owen, and Duddits were only 15 miles south of Pearlie's own position. If that was indeed the case, Henry and Owen were 45 miles back, somewhere between Pittsfield and Waterville. Mr. Gray didn't believe that actually qualified as sniffing up one's tailpipe. Still, it would not do to linger here. The back door of the restaurant opened. A young man in a uniform the Jonesy files identified as Cook's Whites came out carrying two large bags of garbage, clearly bound for the dumpsters. This young man's name was John, but his friends called him Butch. Mr. Gray thought it would be enjoyable to kill him, but Butch looked a good deal stronger than Jonesy, not to mention younger and probably much quicker. Also, murder had annoying side effects, the worst being how quickly it rendered a stolen car useless.
"Hey, Butch."
Butch stopped, looking at him alertly.
"Which car is yours?"
Actually, it wasn't his, but his mother's, and that was good. Butch's own rust bucket was back home, victim of a dead battery. He had his mom's unit, an all-wheel drive Subaru. Mr. Gray, Jonesy would have said, had just rolled another 7. Butch handed over the keys willingly enough. He still looked alert. Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed was how Jonesy put it, although the young cook had no tail, Mr. Gray could see. But his consciousness was gone.
Out on his feet, Jonesy thought. You won't remember this, Mr. Gray said.
No, Butch agreed.
Just back to work.
You bet, Butch agreed. He picked up his bags of garbage and headed for the dumpsters again. By the time his shift was over and he realized his mother's car was gone, all this would likely be over. Mr. Gray unlocked the red Subaru and got in. There was half a bag of barbecue potato chips on the seat. Mr. Gray gobbled them greedily as he drove back to the plow. He finished by licking Jonesy's fingers. Greasy. Good. Like the bacon. He got the dog. 5 minutes later, he was on the turnpike again. South and south and south. The night roars with music and laughter and loud voices. The air is big with the smell of grilled hot dogs, chocolate, roasted peanuts. The sky blooms with colored fire. Binding it all together, identifying it, signing it like summer's own autograph, is an amplified rock and roll song from the speakers that have been set up in Strawford Park. Hey, pretty baby, take a ride with me, going down to Alabama on the C&C. And here comes the tallest cowboy in the world, a 9-foot Pecos Bill under the burning sky, towering over the crowd, little kids with their ice cream smeared mouths dropped open in wonder, their eyes wide. Laughing parents hold them up or put them on their shoulders so they can see better. In one hand, Pecos Bill waves his hat. In the other, a banner which reads, Dairy Days, 1981.